But we begin today with the pride of, first of all, we're, you know, every radio broadcaster, everybody that's on radio, and most radio broadcasters are here in Indianapolis for the big national radio convention of the National Association of Broadcasters. The only big radio person that is not in town for the NAB radio show is Tavis Smiley, because Tavis is a little busy. Tavis is here because he has a brand new book published by Little Brown. This is a must-read book, no joke, because it is called Death of a King, the real story of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s final year from the early part of 1967 until he was taken out, taken away from us on April the 4th, 1968. Tavis is also involved in some other stuff. We may get to that a little bit later because some of y'all are interested in that, but I'm trying to help him with the book now. I'm trying, I want you to overcome Amazon and all this book selling stuff on our live line. He's not at the convention, but he's here with me by a on our live line. The one and only Tavis Smiley. How you doing, brother?
I'm doing well, Amos Brown. I am always better when I hear your voice. How are you doing?
I'm fine. Can you believe the radio industry is actually having their convention in Indianapolis?
Of course I can. I can believe it because I mean, every time I come home, I am always amazed. I mean, I'm pleasantly amazed at how much the city of Indianapolis has grown. I mean, it really is on its way to becoming a cosmopolitan city. I mean, I remember growing up, of course, in Indiana and growing up in the Kokomo area of Kokomo, coming to Indianapolis is always a big deal for us, especially long before Kokomo got a White Castle. I had to come to Indianapolis to get one. And I remember growing up listening to WTLC. I mean, Indianapolis was a great city then, but over the years, it's become so cosmopolitan, and I celebrate it every time I come home. I see all kinds of conventions that are happening there, but most importantly, we are blessed in Indiana to have your voice on the radio then and still now. So it's always a delight to be on your program, man.
Well, it is a delight to be here. We trying to do this 40th year. You know, when you get to 40, and in this business, to get to 40 is a major accomplishment.
Well, it is a major accomplishment to be around that long, to have something worth saying that people need to hear, but most importantly, to be loved by the people the way you have been. You've been loved by the folks in Indianapolis and embraced by them for years, and I don't know what they're planning for your 40th, but I hope somebody invites me to be a part of it.
All right, well, you may hear from somebody. Anyway, the new book, Serious Business, Death of a King, the last year of Dr. Martin Luther King. The book opens just as Dr. King is getting ready to make a major sermon in one of the biggest mainline churches in New York. Start us out. How did the book come about?
I just landed in New York, so I'm here now on book tour. And I'm just down the street from the Riverside Church in on the west side of Manhattan, upper west side of Manhattan, where King, on April 4, 1967, gave a speech that's entitled Beyond Vietnam. On April 4, 67, he steps to the lectern, the podium in the Riverside Church, and gives this speech in which he calls America the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today. Now, imagine, Amos, a black man in 1967, even one with a Nobel Peace Prize, standing up and telling white America that your country is the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today. That's April 4, 67. A year to the day later, same day, 1 year later, April 4, 1968, King is shot dead. So this book does what has not been done by any book before, to look exactly at that last year, 12 months to the day, 365 days to the day, what happens to Martin King in the last year of his life once he gives that speech and everybody and everything turns on him, including black people.
Because African Americans, if my history is right, were, on for the most part, supportive of the Vietnam War at that point.
They were very much supportive of Lyndon Johnson, who was fighting the Vietnam War, and for all the obvious reasons, Lyndon Johnson, many black people thought, had been the best white, the best president, they were all white, but he'd been the best president that black folk had had since Lincoln freed the slaves. So Johnson comes through after Kennedy, and what does he do? He passes, as you know, the Voting Rights Act, the Civil Rights Act. So here's Martin King, who's worked with Johnson on these two seminal pieces of legislation. But now he's turning against Johnson on the war question. And so the bourgeois elite Negroes were like, Negro, have you lost your mind? So Roy Wilkins at the NAACP comes out publicly against King. Whitney Young at the Urban League comes out publicly against Dr. King. Ralph Bunche, the only other black Nobel laureate, publicly comes out against Dr. King. Adam Clayton Powell Jr. comes out publicly against Dr. King. Karl Rowan, the most preeminent black journalist of the day, comes out publicly against Dr. King. So it's these bourgeois elite black folk, but also the black press down the line, have been supportive of King. The white press turns on him. The black press turns on him. The White House turns on him. The last poll taken in his life, the Harris poll, Amos, found that 75%, three-quarters of the American people, thought Dr. King was irrelevant in the last year of his life. And, hold on to your hats, almost 60%, 60, of black people thought he was persona non grata. That's the way that Martin got out of here.
Is what kept him going?
His love for people. His love for people, his commitment to being a truth teller, no matter the consequences. He knew that the death angel was hovering over him. People think that that mountaintop speech that he gave the night before he was assassinated, people think that speech was the speech that underscores the fact that he knew he wasn't going to make it. Well, that was a great speech, and he did know he wasn't going to be here much longer. But he'd been telling his inner circle for a long time that he knew his days were limited. And every time he told them that, they would brush him off. They didn't want to hear it. And so Martin really, with all the folk around him, really didn't have anybody he could confide in who really was hearing his heart and helping him deal with this burden that he was bearing. Even Coretta could not understand that kind of frantic melancholy that Martin was experiencing. So he had to walk that journey alone, and even his inner circle, he could not get his own team to agree with him on the poor people's campaign that he was working on. He called his own team a team of wild horses. And so Martin really in the last year doesn't have a real constituency. He can't get a book deal. He can't get a paid speech. His organization is bankrupt. His health is suffering. He's gaining weight. He's smoking a little bit more, drinking a little bit more because the pressure on him and the death threats against him are so great. But most importantly, the truth that he was trying to tell about what he called the triple threat of racism, poverty, and militarism was falling, Amos, on deaf ears.
If was there in the book, because part of the American establishment started to turn against the war after the Tet Offensive, the legendary remarks by Walter Cronkite in a two-part special broadcast of the CBS Evening News, where he basically broke down what was going on in Vietnam, and basically you basically said we ain't gonna win this thing. To paraphrase
that,
did Dr. King realize that maybe the country was starting to come towards his side in the couple of months before his death?
Not so much. Not so much. It hadn't turned as swiftly as he wanted it to. There were signs that Johnson was rethinking the war, in part because before King died, Johnson announced that he was not, as you recall, going to seek re-election. He didn't want to seek it, and if nominated, he said, I would not serve. So Johnson had made it clear that he wasn't going to seek re-election. Bobby Kennedy's name was in the hat. Eugene McCarthy's name was in the hat. So it was clear that Johnson knew that he had, in some ways, tore his draws with the American people so badly that he didn't really stand a chance at being reelected. So there were some signs that this Vietnam thing was going to turn, not so much by the time he died.
In terms of the historical importance of this book, why is this book important for listeners to really read and understand how you keep pressing forward when everybody else shuns you? I mean, it's almost like Peter and Jesus magnified a thousand times.
Like you, since you just referenced Jesus, there's a song we sang in my little church called New Bethel Tabernacle just up the road in Kokomo, Indiana. I first learned this song. Must Jesus bear the cross alone and all the world go free? No, there's a cross for everyone. And there's a cross for me. And what you're really asking, Amos, is whether or not we're prepared to accept the fact that each of us, even if we're atheists or agnostics, in our lives, we have to be willing to bear some kind of cross. Dr. King used to always say, life's most persistent and urgent question is, what are you doing for others? What kind of sacrifice, what kind of service are you willing to render to others? And in the process of loving people, you're going to have to suffer just a little bit. And so I hope that folks will read this book for three reasons. Number one, this is the story about Dr. King. I can assure you that you don't know, because the narrative they teach us of Dr. King, to the extent we know anything, is that King only gave Amos one speech in his whole life.
Right. Yeah.
And that speech only had one line in it, that my children will live in a nation where they'll not be judged by the color of their skin, by the content of their character. That's all we know from I Have a Dream. So this is the story of Martin King that you don't know, number one. Number two, whether you're talking Amos Brown or Tavis Smiley or anybody else, we really, as human beings, come to know who we are in the darkest and most difficult days of our lives. So if you think you know Dr. King, but you don't know the story of his last year, when it was the most difficult and the darkest, then you really don't know him as yet. And number three, I regard Dr. King as the greatest American this country has ever produced. I regard him as America's greatest democratic, small d, not a big d, America's greatest democratic public intellectual. I think when you read this book, you might come to agree with me on that.
Is it also, you know, in biographies after somebody has passed on for a number of years, or are the biographies that tell the whole story of the individual, the good and the not so good? You mentioned, you know, Dr. King smoking, which a lot of people don't know. I even think some of the movies have not really shown that. He took a nip of the alcohol every now and then. I heard he said words that you only hear on cable after 12 midnight. Have some reviewers focused on his flaws in the book, or really have they taken a look at the whole man?
I think that most reviewers, and there have been a number of reviews already, I'm happy to say that the book just came out yesterday. And on the first day, this is my 17th book, and I think I've talked to you for most of them. This is my 17th book, but the first time I've ever had the experience of getting a call from the publisher telling me that on day one, on the first day the book is out, they have gone back to reprint already.
Got the bullet on the day, on the what, day one?
On day one, got a bullet. So that's a beautiful thing that the book is that people are responding to it. And they're responding in part because we don't pull any punches.
Mm-hmm.
It's a book that is truthful, but a book that is loving. Dr. King was a public servant. He was not a perfect servant.
Mm-hmm.
And we got, again, on the one hand, we have to stop sanitizing and sterilizing and lionizing him and let people see him in the fullness and the complexity of his humanity. And that, quite frankly, is what makes him such a bad man, that he was human like all the rest of us, but with all this hell and hate coming at him, he found a way to get up every single day, Amos, and keep telling the truth. One more bit of information that most people don't know, which will blow your mind. So King is assassinated on Thursday night on that balcony in Memphis, because in the good old days, they used to pass out bulletins on Sunday morning when you got to church, Amos.
Right.
So King, in order for the bulletin to be passed out Sunday morning, had to call in to his church. He's always on the road. So on Thursday or Friday, he had to call in his sermon topic for Sunday morning so it could be typed up in the bulletin with the rest of the order of services.
Mm-hmm.
The sermon that King was going to preach, had he made it back to Atlanta on Sunday morning, was entitled, Why America May Go to Hell. Why America, he didn't say we were going to hell. May is the operative word here. Why America may go to hell. And the sermon was going to be built upon this triple threat: racism, poverty, and militarism. If we don't start to deal with these three issues, America's going to hell. We're going to lose our democracy. And what do we see almost 50 years later in Ferguson, Missouri? Racism, poverty, and militarism, Amos.
We're talking with Tavis Smiley. The book is published by Little Brown. It is called Death of a King. It is available wherever you get your books from. Legitimate book. You know, we're not talking about the bootlegger down on the corner. But we're talking about Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com, Barnes & Noble regular bookstores. And in Walmart?
Everywhere.
Hardcover, Tavis reads to you in the car or on the podcast, all kind of things. A couple of things. Now, since you're in New York, and I hear you're gonna be on that Morning Joe guy. Somebody told me that, whispered in my ear. Which means tomorrow, they're not gonna ask you about the book. They're gonna ask you about whatever the president is gonna say at 9 o'clock, tomorrow night. How difficult a decision does he have, because airstrikes can only do so much. I mean, that has been proven going back to World War II. You can only do so much with airstrikes. Eventually, somebody's boot has to do something.
Yeah, I feel for the president in this regard because this is not a this speech that he's giving tonight at 9 o'clock is not going to be an easy speech to give. He's in a difficult and tough situation, and yet, with all due respect to the president, I've been disappointed in those of us in the black community, in the spirit and tradition of Dr. King, who have not been more vocal in this presidency about the increasing militarism of the American empire that he heads. This drone program that we've been using, since you're talking about airstrikes, this drone program that we've been using is on steroids. Barack Obama has used more drones than George Bush. He's killed more innocent women and children than George Bush. We say on the one hand we're fighting terrorism, but if you kill too many innocent women and children, you create more terrorists because their families want to get revenge on the American empire. And I wish that we had had up until now a more robust conversation about the increasing militarism of the American empire. Black folk have gone silent on that issue. And again, back to King, racism, poverty, and militarism. He would have something to say about the increasing militarism, even though the president doesn't have any good choices. So that all I can tell you is I'm pulling and praying for him every single day. But I often wonder, Amos, what that bust of Dr. King in the Oval Office must be whispering to the president when he's working late at night.
We're with Tavis Smiley. So now you got a book that they've already run out of printing, so they got to go to the printing press and make some more, like Doritos, make some more. You know, everybody's going to be asking you tomorrow as it relates to what the president says tonight about ISIS. Then Monday night, 2 hours, you dancing with, what is this about, Doc?
I know. So let me just put it this way. I'm doing Dancing with the Stars. They came after me 2 or 3 times. I told them no. And on the third time, they asked me would I take a meeting. And I said, you know what? I'm going to take a meeting. And after the meeting, I sat down and did the old school thing, Amos. I pulled out my little notepad and I drew a line down in the middle of the page and I wrote pros and cons. And to my surprise, quite frankly, to my horror on a certain level, the reasons to do the show outnumbered the reasons not to do the show. Now, you know, years ago, I was working really, really hard to be taken seriously as a broadcaster. And I think whether folk agree or disagree with me, I think I've earned the respect that I have gotten over the years. So I might not have done this some years ago, but it just so happens that in a few days from now, literally, I'm about to turn 50, believe it or not.
Oh, Lord.
And I thought I would do one last foolish, ridiculous, stupid, crazy thing, Amos, before I turn 50. And this is definitely it. And you know a bit about my background. I love my parents, mm-hmm. and my faith means more to me than anything in the world. But it is the case that I was raised as a child in a faith tradition that didn't allow me to listen to secular music. Mm-hmm. I couldn't listen to secular music. I was class president in junior high, in my junior and senior year of high school. I was class president both years. I couldn't go to the prom. I couldn't watch Soul Train. I couldn't watch American Bandstand. I never had a chance to experience music in its fullness until I got to college. Right. And I'm a lover of music, and as a broadcaster, I've interviewed every great dancer in the world because I love the art of dance. I love the Hines brothers and the Nicholas brothers, and I've interviewed Mikhail Baryshnikov and Judith Jamison and Lil Buck and Misty Copeland, and you name it, I've interviewed them.
So now have you called any of them and said, can you, Brother Baryshnikov, can you give me some tips?
As a matter of fact, I had Savion Glover on the program this week, and I asked Savion for some tips, and it was actually funny. I said, Savion, I'm doing Dancing with the Stars. He said, I heard. I said, any advice you can give me? He fell on his knees, and he said, Tavis, let us pray.
Now this young lady, Sharna Burgess, and I'm looking at the official picture where right. You're kind of standing there stiff as I would be, and yeah. Miss Burgess, well, she got some soul in her. First of all, can she help a brother?
Oh, she's helping me a lot. I can tell you now, I cannot tell you what the song is going to be Monday night, but I will tell you, I'll give you a hint to my hometown, Indianapolis. It is a song by one of the greatest artists ever, who happened to be on the Motown label.
Oh.
So you know I'm dancing to something soulful Monday night.
You better
be. I guarantee you that.
You better be.
And I can also, what I can tell you though, my hometown fans, my first dance this coming Monday night is the Foxtrot. Now, this is a very difficult dance. I asked Sean and my partner on a scale of 1 to 10, how difficult is this? She said an 8. I might have had a heart attack. I felt like Fred Sanford Elizabeth, this is the big one. This is the big one. Well, so I've been working on the Foxtrot. I think I've got it down now, but it's going to be a great, it's been a lot of fun.
Now I got to tell you, the gods of television here in Indianapolis have not made this easy for you, because Monday Night Football is our Indianapolis Colts against the Philadelphia Eagles here at home at Lucas Oil Stadium. Yeah. And, you know, even though that's an ESPN game, a local station has the ability to outbid somebody to carry the game. And unfortunately, it is the ABC affiliate, Channel 6, that is going to be airing the game instead of Dancing with the Stars. Now, go ahead.
No, my dad had already told me, even before that happened, that he was going to be watching the football game.
Now, here's the good news. Channel 6 announced this morning that Dancing with the Stars, the 2-hour premiere, will be this coming Tuesday afternoon from 3 to 5, leading into the early news from 3 to 5. And they said, once you figure out that you can go to abc.com between 10 to 11, on Monday night, and cast your vote for Tavis Smiley.
Yeah,
Before you even see him, just cast. So while Andrew Luck is taking care of business against the Eagles, you know, in the third quarter, you could be just dialing your phone, Tavis.
You know what, Amos? The Lord works in mysterious ways, because it might be better for you to vote for me before you see me anyway.
Anyway, I mean, how many best-selling authors have ever been on Dancing with the Stars? Let's look at it that way.
Yeah, I don't know. It's gonna be a lot of fun. I mean, I figure, you know, if I can't do something at 50 that I've never done before, try something different. When will I ever do it? It's a lot of fun. I can tell you one thing. It certainly gets you in shape. I've lost about 20 pounds in just a few weeks, man. So it gets you in shape. I'm actually really starting to enjoy it. And the Foxtrot, again, is the most difficult for me. But once we get to the cha-cha-cha and a few other things, I think I might make a run for it, Amy.
Well, as long as you keep that Len Goodman and that Bruno under control.
Yeah.
if they act a fool, you know, Indiana may just come and rise up and come and get them. The book is called Death of a King. It is published by Little Brown. It is on sale wherever books are sold. The real story of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s final year. It is a must read from Indiana's own Tavis Smiley. It's always good to talk to you, my brother. Thank you.
Amos, I love you. You stay strong now.
All right, I will.